welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. I'm not sure when this is actually going to get published, but it is being recorded on the 19th of April, 2023, and I don't have my usual co-host with me today. We don't have Max Musson. We actually have Laura Towler from patrioticalternative.org.uk and grandmataylors.co.uk. The very well-known Laura Towler, who we've had on Radio Albion before, deputy leader of Patriotic Alternative and also a big fan of Oswald Mosley. Laura, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey Sven, thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you, and I hope I can do justice to the notes that we've put together and been reading. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I wanted to get you involved in some part with this series anyway, because I know it's like a specialist subject of yours. We've been using Wikipedia notes for a lot of all the past episodes, but this week we actually have some notes which have been written by someone like yourself who is interested in Oswald Mosley, and we're going to be concentrating on Regulation 18B. And we'll begin here. The position of Mosley and British Union was clear. They opposed the war. When the war started, they campaigned for a negotiated peace, securing British independence and leaving the British Empire intact. This was something which Hitler offered on many occasions. In the meantime, however, no member would do anything to endanger his country. And at the beginning of September 1939, Mosley issued the following message to members of British Union. To our members, my message is plain and clear. Our country is involved in war. Therefore, I ask you to do nothing to injure our country or to help any other power. Our members should do what the law requires of them, and if they are members of any of the forces or services of the Crown, they should obey their orders, and in particular, obey the rules of their service. We have said 100 times that if the life of Britain were threatened, we would fight again. Young blackshirts fought with their fellow countrymen on the basis of my country, right or wrong, even though they considered the war to be unnecessary and against Britain's interests. The first British casualty listed in the war was a blackshirt, aircraftsman K.G. Day, who was killed in an RAF raid on the second day of the war. Also among the 10 crew lost in that raid was aircraftsman G.T. Brocking, another blackshirt. Both Day and Brocking were ground crew who had volunteered to be acting air gunners for the raid. Altogether, over 1,000 of Mosley's blackshirts were killed in action during the war. Mosley and other members of British Union who were not enlisted in the services bravely continued their campaign for a negotiated peace, holding many public meetings. The war was opposed on the grounds that no British interest was at stake in Poland, and a major war would lead, as it did, to the loss of the British Empire and the rise of Soviet communism in Europe. Only Britain and France intervened in the war. All other countries in Europe were unconcerned, as were the rest of the world. Although the British and French governments claimed to be fighting for Poland, their hypocrisy was soon exposed as war was not declared against the Soviet Union when it invaded Poland just 2 weeks after Germany. So there we get all the information that is not included in Wikipedia, the reason why Mosley was campaigning against the war, the fact that these black shirts weren't traitors, 1,000 of them actually gave their lives in the war. But you can also see here the reason why this was annoying for the British government, because you had somebody that was campaigning for peace and still campaigning for peace and saying, let's not have a war, once the war had actually started. And I think it was that more than anything else that really got on the government's nerves. What do you make of this, Laura?
Oh, gosh, well, there's quite a lot to dig into there. I always quote that the first British casualty who died in the war was a black shirt, because you do get thrown the traitor label around, and you hear it quite a lot on social media. But obviously Mosley himself had fought in the war, and, you know, that was one of the reasons why he opposed it, because he knew the destruction that it would bring. And, you know, people that he fought alongside and his friends had died, and he came back and he was just like, never again. But I think there's this argument that you hear from the far left sometimes, where they say things like, You know, you're a Nazi, you're a fascist. Our grandparents fought against people like you in the war. And it was like, no, actually, our grandparents had exactly the same opinions as us, and they were fighting for their people and their country. And that's something that you're trying to give away today. So this notion of being a traitor because you're a nationalist is just, it's just completely juxtaposed, isn't it? It's the opposite of what it is. You love your people and you don't want your people to go and die in pointless wars. Therefore, you're anti-war. And I think it's an argument that our opposition and anti-whites really struggle to fight against and argue against. But I think mainly it's because they don't understand it. They probably think that because we're nationalists, we're big, bad, evil people and we want war. But when we explain our beliefs and why we believe them, they have to just misrepresent us because what we're saying is perfectly reasonable.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't a fight against national socialism as such. It was a concern that they were going to be invaded by Germany. I mean, that was the reason why Britain was fighting. They didn't want to be invaded by Germany. It wasn't to interfere with the democratically elected party in Germany. A lot of the things that we're told today, that we were fighting for democracy and things like that, people aren't going to give their lives for democracy, but they are going to give their lives if they think their country is going to be invaded by another country. And this is what Mosley was saying here. If we are invaded by foreigners, we will fight back against the foreigners, regardless of whether we wanted this war or not. We will give ourselves 100% to our country. And I also find it interesting that he foretold the end of the British Empire through the war, which is exactly what happened. Well, Winston Churchill became Prime Minister on 10th of May 1940 after the downfall of Neville Chamberlain. And remember, Mosley almost beat Neville Chamberlain when he was up against him for election. But after the downfall of Neville Chamberlain, following the Norway debacle, which ironically Churchill had instigated, now the war began going from bad to worse for Britain. The Germans broke through the French lines and Allied forces were soon in disarray. A coalition government was formed with the Labour Party, and there is evidence that Labour made participation conditional on the imprisonment of Mosley and other people they did not like and could not answer. The author and historian Hugh Ross Williamson, a Labour parliamentary candidate at the time, recorded in a letter on the 17th of July 1942 that at the Bournemouth Conference of the Labour Party in 1940, one of the main subjects of conversation which I heard at unofficial talks was whether or not the Labour leaders had made the arrest and imprisonment of Mosley a condition of their entering the government. The general feeling was that they had, or at least that they ought to, and though the matter is obviously incapable of proof, it is still accepted by many of us as the real reason for 18B, and 18B was the regulation that saw them all imprisoned. Condition or not, Churchill and other warmongers in his cabinet clearly thought it was a good idea to silence the opposition and generally intimidate the people now that things were going wrong. And I know we look at this and we say, well, it's the left and the left wanting the right to be imprisoned. But at this time, it wasn't really left or right, because Mosley had been a member of the Labour Party as well as the Conservative Party. And it was his financial memorandum, his economic memorandum, that was the most important thing to him. And he really wanted the Labour Party to take this on. So it surprises me that the Labour Party were so against him. I mean, what do you make of this, Laura?
Yeah, I would say that it's something that transcends left and right. And I would say that left back then anyway isn't left as we know it today. I mean, left back then is probably way past right today, because things have changed so much. But I think the thing that stands out to me is just how it's not changed to today. If you're countering the system today, you're going to face exactly the same dirty tactics and silencing. And obviously, you know, you're going through a lot yourself just for words. Myself and Mark at Patriotic Alternative, we've been featured in government reports where they've said that we don't break the law with the things that we do. So they want to change the law so that they can stop us talking about the things that we talk about. And one of the examples that they gave was us talking about demographics and saying that white British people are on track to becoming a minority by 2066 or before. So it's exactly the same today. It's not changed. And, you know, Mosley went through it back then, and Patriotic Alternative and others are going through it today. They can't debate these ideas, and there's no democracy, no real democracy anywhere. So they do what they've always done, and that's just try to silence people.
Well, at least they're saying, well, we need to change the law to get you today. I mean, back then, they literally broke the law. We have this thing called habeas corpus, where you have to be told the reason why you've been imprisoned. And they didn't have that. They never actually charged Mosley and his men with any crime. So they really sort of broke all the rules of democracy by doing this. But we do see a similar thing happening in Ukraine recently. I mean, they banned the opposition, didn't they? I'm not sure if they locked all the opposition up, but they did ban the opposition. And I guess you can see that if you're in wartime, you don't want people that are against the war. You want everybody to be giving 100% for your country. But Mosley did say he ordered all his men to give 100% to the country. Well, as it happened, it seems that even 18B, as originally issued, provided insufficient grounds to imprison Mosley and his followers. 2 parliamentary sitting days after Labour joined the government, and 4 days after the Labour conference, a special amendment, Clause 1A, was rushed through Parliament. The amendment virtually allowed the Home Secretary to jail anyone he liked at his discretion. And the very next day, the first arrests, including that of Mosley, took place. Apart from 800 members of British Union, several hundred others were arrested, including Admiral Barry Domville, the former Chief of Naval Intelligence, and Captain Ramsay, the Conservative MP for Mid Lothian. Both Domville and Ramsay had formed organisations not connected to British Union to campaign for peace. Among British Union members imprisoned were holders of every medal for valour which could be awarded to British servicemen, except the Victoria Cross. And one blackshirt did hold the Victoria Cross, but even Churchill shrunk from throwing him into jail. Some blackshirts were arrested while serving in the local defence volunteers and the civil defence, and some blackshirt servicemen rescued at Dunkirk were arrested back in England. One blackshirt, an amateur yachtsman, was arrested immediately after returning from Dunkirk, where he had just helped to evacuate British troops. Men and women from all walks of life were rounded up. One notable victim was a farmer, Jorian Jenks, who was prospective British Union candidate for Horsham, a pioneer of the ecology movement in Britain, and later a founder of the Soil Association. So, I mean, I was unaware of that. I was unaware that there were all these other people that were arrested as well. I mean, you've even got like a serving Conservative MP that was thrown in jail here. And I guess the spotlight is all on the British Union guys, the black shirts that were arrested, but there were all these others as well. And one of the problems with this, once they were arrested, they didn't actually give any help to the dependents. So you had wives and children that were left at home, and there was nothing that was provided for them. Not like today when, you have the welfare system. We didn't have the welfare system back then. So you had wives and children. Some of them ended up having to go back to the countries that they came from. Some of them went back to Ireland, and others basically just starved. I mean, it was a terrible thing that went on here. Were you aware that there were these other people that were thrown in jail as well, Laura?
I wasn't actually, no, not until you sent me these notes over and I read through them. But I mean, that's a pretty damning piece of evidence, isn't it? If they just take all these individuals and organisations that are all campaigning for peace and then throw them away so that they can't talk anymore. I don't think you can get a more damning piece of evidence than that. And it would be interesting actually to go back and read the newspaper articles at the time. I do like to do that quite often because I feel like narratives change and then people say, oh, you know, this is a narrative that we had back then. Like, for example, we invited the Windrush people over to take jobs that, you know, were here and create the NHS and all this kind of stuff. If you go back and read the newspaper articles from the time, the articles about the Windrush generation from like Clement Attlee and George Isaacs and stuff are saying that they didn't invite them over here and they hope that no more of them come over. But narratives change over time. And there are quite a lot of newspaper articles that I've read, actually, that supported Mosley and supported the Blackshirts and the BUF. But those newspapers, which many of them are still in existence today, would never admit that that was a popular narrative back then. So I think it would be good to check out some newspaper articles about this and just see how honest they're being, really, and how they presented that, you know, how they got away with it.
Yeah, how they reported this, because you've got no other representatives of the BUF that left that can actually talk to them. So I guess the newspapers could have printed whatever they wanted. And I know from talking to elderly people in their 70s and their 80s, and you talk to them about Oswald Mosley and they say, oh, yes, he was the guy that was the traitor that was jailed during the war. Otherwise, he would have given the information to the Germans how they could come and take over. And that was the way that it was portrayed. And I do wonder if that must have come from the newspapers at the time, because they were supporting him up until the war. But I think when he was going against the war and was wanting to make peace, I can see that the newspapers probably would have changed, because, you know, they would have been united in supporting the government at that point. I mean, you can say that there is an issue there, that you've got a group that are saying we want peace. They're effectively saying we don't want war. So you can see that there is going to be this concern there. But should they have been jailed for this? I mean, because it looks as if it was just used to round up anybody that was in opposition to the government. I guess we should just be glad that they don't do that today. They do still have to use the law, but they are still jailing people for being the opposition, basically, for speaking up against government policies.
Well, there was the Conservative guy, I've forgotten his name now, who started asking questions about the COVID vaccine, and he got suspended, didn't he? And they just basically memory holed him. So if you go against the official narrative, whether it's regards to COVID or whether it's regards to, I don't know, the war in Ukraine, they just do whatever they can to shut you up.
Yeah, that's Andrew Bridgen, isn't it? Mm. Andrew Bridgen. And they accused him of being a conspiracy theorist and an anti-Semite and all sorts for what he said about COVID, which is very telling, you know, that these words are used to shut down the opposition. And I should imagine they probably were still using words like anti-Semite back then against Oswald Mosley, but I'm not sure they would have been using words like racist, and they were probably calling him Nazi as well, or a Nazi sympathizer. But as you can see here, all the people that didn't want war were all the people that had lots and lots of medals, that had fought with distinction in the First World War, and they didn't want to see us going through that again, and another huge, great loss of life. And they knew that it would lead to the loss of the empire as well, and Britain's position in the world, and they were proved right in that. Well, not surprisingly, it was difficult for the government to justify the mass arrests, particularly as it claimed to be fighting for freedom. A propaganda campaign was instigated about the fifth columnists, clearly aimed at the internees who were in no position to reply effectively. Yet just 2 weeks before the first arrests, when fears of invasion were mounting, Mosley had issued the following message to members of British Union. According to the press, stories concerning the invasion of Britain are being circulated. In such an event, every member of British Union would be at the disposal of the nation. Every one of us would resist the foreign invader with all that is in us. However rotten the existing government, and however much we detested its policies, we would throw ourselves into the effort of a united nation until the foreigner was driven from our soil. In such a situation, no doubt exists concerning the attitude of British Union. No acts of disloyalty could be proved against any of British Union's members. They declared themselves in favour of a negotiated peace, but that was a far cry from wanting Britain's defeat. Mosley succeeded in establishing the real reason for his imprisonment at his hearing before the Advisory Committee, set up by government to consider appeals against internment. This was a whitewash operation designed to give the false impression that there was some justice or legality involved in the mass arrests. In fact, all members of the committee, one of whom at least, namely Anthony Blunt, was a real traitor, were appointed by the government and they had no power at all. The final decision lay within the complete discretion of the Home Secretary. Nevertheless, Mosley did get a significant admission from the committee's chairman, Mr., later Lord, Justice Birkett. Their exchange of words was subsequently revealed in the House of Commons without challenge from any quarter, then or since, by Mr. R.R. Stokes, MP, who later became a minister in a Labour government. He became the Minister of Works, 1945-51. After 16 hours cross-examination in the private committees to consider 18B cases, Mr. Norman Birkett indulged in this conversation with Sir Oswald Mosley, which I think ought to be quoted and put on the record, whatever one's feelings. Sir Oswald Mosley said to Mr. Burkitt, "There appear to be two grounds for detaining us, a suggestion that we are traitors who would take up arms and fight with the Germans if they landed, and that our propaganda undermines the civilian morale." Mr. Burkitt replied, "Speaking for myself, you can entirely dismiss the first suggestion." Sir Oswald Mosley, "Then I can only assume that we have been detained because of our campaign in favour of a negotiated peace." And Mr. Norman Burkitt, "Yes, Sir Oswald, that is the case." And that's an extract from Hansard, 10th of December, 1940. So it was about how damaging this could be to morale. And it could be damaging to morale if you've got people saying, you know, we don't want to be going to war. We should be having a peace. So it is something that has to be balanced. I mean, but they could have said to him, you need to stop campaigning for peace. If you're going to be 100% behind the country, stop campaigning for peace and encourage your men to fight. Which he was doing. He was encouraging his men to fight. And as it says here, they didn't have this concern that he wasn't going to fight. It was just about his campaign in favour of a negotiated peace. And I think also where Mosley is saying that there have been these reports circulated by the press about invasion, I think the press would have also been stirring things up a bit by that time. And it would have turned them against Mosley. You know, possibly there could have been feeling that was against Mosley for promoting peace when the country was at war. I mean, what do you make of what it says here, Laura?
Oh, gosh, well, where to begin with that, really? I mean, in a way, we're lucky that we have social media today because we do have a platform to be able to spread a message. And I suppose back there, the press or the traditional press as we know it today dominated everything. Whereas today, even though they suspend us from like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, there are still millions of other people on there that can get a message out. Whereas I imagine back then, things were buried more. I mean, they have to present this facade of democracy and, you know, freedom of opinion and what did we used to say, Britain is a free country and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's probably why they just got rid of them as opposed to telling them what they can and can't talk about, because if they get rid of them and then just hush it up, nobody really says anything. However, if they say you can't talk about this but you're still out there you know, spreading your message and stuff, then obviously there's going to be more eyes and attention on that, and they're going to show their hand a little bit. So I imagine that that's why they did it. But yeah, it just, I think in a lot of ways we think that it was maybe easier back then because the demographics were better and more in our favour. But I think in some ways it's definitely easy today, and especially reading through this document, you know, about not even having to follow laws, they still do put that pantomime on in Britain and at least pretend that they're following laws today. But back then it just seemed like they did whatever they want and nobody held them to account.
I think another point that can be looked at is that there was still support from the establishment for him as well. I mean, that person he was talking to then said, well, I personally do not doubt your commitment to the country. And also he was in the Conservative Party, he was in the Labour Party, and he was Sir Oswald Mosley. I mean, he was looked upon quite highly. He was a part of the aristocracy and he did have this aristocratic support. And today, you know, we don't have that support. I mean, if you look, I think it was the Daily Express as well, or even the Daily Mirror, that used to talk favourably about the British Union and about Oswald Mosley. And we don't have any mainstream newspapers today that would talk favourably about us. And you can look at the meetings that he had, these huge meetings that he was able to put on. And I guess we're limited in putting on these meetings today because of getting them shut down. But Oswald Mosley had that to contend with as well. A lot of his meetings were shut down, and that was why he ended up forming this security detail, the Black Shirts, is because there was so much violence that was directed at them by communists and by groups claiming to be representing Jewish interests. So they had to have this security. So in some ways, it's similar to what is going on today. In some ways, it was easier for them. And in other ways, it wasn't easier for them. I mean, the big difference today, obviously, as you said there, Laura, is the internet. Being able to have our own media, give our own interviews. But again, our own media doesn't reach that many people. And the newspapers back then, they would reach a lot more people. And he did get favourable news coverage at first, but this really sort of put an end to it, I think. And also, I think there were different factions. I think Neville Chamberlain was quite a good prime minister, I think there were still quite a few good people that were actually within parliament at this time. And then you got Winston Churchill that got put in there with this coalition government. And it was from then, I think, that things really took a turn for the worst. Up to this point, you could still have people like Oswald Mosley that were part of the establishment. Captain Ramsay there as well, this MP, this Conservative MP, he's somebody that I've read about. He's a nationalist as well. So you had nationalists, open nationalists that were actually part of the Conservative Party, which is something you just don't have today. Do you want to add to that at all, Laura?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, the main narrative against nationalism today is that makes you a Nazi, and that means that you want to put Jews in concentration camps, and they didn't have that argument back then because it hadn't happened yet. So, you know, whenever you say that you're a nationalist today, it's, well, you can't be a nationalist and you can't collectivise with your people if you're white, because that means, you know, Hitler and Holocaust and all this kind of stuff. So I think that's probably why it was easier and less risky to support nationalism, which is obviously, you know, ethnic collectivism for your people and safety and prosperity for your people in their homeland. I think it was easier and safer to promote that back then because they didn't have the number one argument against it.
Yeah, that's a good point. We'll be getting to that as well in these notes. The internees were initially sent to prisons and then to various concentration camps in England and the Isle of Man, where they languished for months and years at the whim of the Home Secretary, separated from family and friends, their lives and careers in tatters. Mosley himself was imprisoned for 3.5 years and was only released when struck down with an illness which doctors certified would be fatal if he remained imprisoned. Remember, this is a member of the aristocracy. And if a member of the aristocracy got so ill, he would have died if he remained in prison. What happened to all these other black shirts that weren't members of the aristocracy? I mean, I think Mosley had a house, or his wife had a house on these prison grounds. But these others have been put in concentration camps, which is, of course, the allegation that was made against Germany, was the conditions of their concentration camps. What about the concentration camps that we had, that we put the opposition in? Many of the internees spent time in the notorious Camp 20 at Ham Common. This was a secret camp, not disclosed to the International Red Cross, not surprisingly, as it subjected its victims to long periods of solitary confinement and intense psychological torture in order to obtain confessions or information. Again, this is interesting, not disclosed to the International Red Cross. You know, the only other camps that weren't disclosed to the International Red Cross were Stalin's in the Gulag. The Red Cross weren't allowed in the Gulag. Well, they also weren't allowed in this camp that we actually had in Britain. They were allowed in the German camps, but not in this British one. The hate campaign against the internees even continued after their release. No apologies have been made or compensation paid. Instead, the authorities imposed further losses where they could. Thus, civil servants such as Andrew Burns were deprived of their pensions in respect of the period of their detention. There seems no doubt, however, that many people involved in the operation of 18B against innocent people were deeply ashamed. This is evidenced by the fact that most public records relating to the detentions have been deliberately destroyed. When the records were released under the 30-year rule, files of only 18 out of some 800 British Union detainees were made available. Initially, it was claimed that they had gone missing. Then it was admitted that they had been destroyed as being of no historical interest. Thus, it seems that the imprisonment of hundreds of political opponents in concentration camps in Britain without charge or trial is not a matter of historical interest to the establishment. Someone who was clearly embarrassed by the detentions was Lord Jowett, who was Lord Chancellor in the Labour government 1945-51. In a House of Lords debate on 11th of December 1946, he stated, "I am not going to embark on a controversy as to whether Sir Oswald Mosley is an ordinary or extraordinary man, but we all agree that he was a very prominent man, and everybody in this country, and I suppose a very large number of people abroad, know him by name and know the sort of action which he took. After all, let us be fair to those people who were imprisoned under Order 18B, and let us remember that they have never been accused of any crime. Not only have they not been convicted of a crime, but they have not been accused of a crime, and that should be remembered in all fairness to them." Extract from Hansard, 11th of December, 1946. So there were people that were embarrassed by it. I mean, this was the Lord Chancellor in the Labour government. So there was still support for him in high places and embarrassment about doing this, especially when we're saying, well, we're fighting for democracy, but we lock up the opposition in prisons and we don't give them habeas corpus. And we leave them in such a state that they almost died in the prison. What do you think of this, Laura? Do you know about the conditions that Sir Oswald Mosley and Lady Mosley were in? Any more details on that, where they were kept?
No, not in too much depth. I mean, I know obviously that it happened, but I don't know the details of where they were kept and stuff. I just think I don't have much to add on this section, but it just, they always memory hole things, don't they, when they know that it makes them look bad. And it's similar to how, I think there's maybe a little bit about this later on down the article, but they talk about how it's not in the public's interest to make something public. And it's usually something that it really is in the public's interest to make public, because it's a life or death thing. So if you're campaigning for peace, obviously you don't want British people to die, and then you're being imprisoned for that. That is in the public's interest. And like today, you know, when we ask for information about grooming gangs, rape gangs, whatever you want to call them, we're told, you're not having that because it's not in the public's interest. Well, actually it is, because we want to stop young girls being abused and all this other horrible stuff. So we want to be able to pick up trends and patterns in relation to the attackers. No, it's not in the public's interest. And here they are just destroying information, or conveniently losing information, because they know how it would look on them, I guess.
Well, it's good that we have these notes here that are talking about this. And I did an interview with an old fellow, Mr. I, we called him, and he talked about this time. I think it was from him that he was saying that they had a house. Lady Mosley had a house on the prison grounds, and he talked about some of these people that were locked away and what happened to their families after that weren't looked after. So the information is out there, but you're not going to find it on Wikipedia. As I say, that this came from a website that dealt specifically with Oswald Mosley, so written by somebody who's obviously sympathetic to him, and I think a lot of people were still sympathetic to him at this time, but he's obviously been smeared since the war. We'll move back to Wikipedia for these notes. After the war, Mosley was contacted by his former supporters and persuaded to return to participation in politics. He formed the Union Movement, which called for a single nation state to cover the continent of Europe, known as Europe a Nation, and later attempted to launch a National Party of Europe to this end. He had connections with the Italian neo-fascist political party Movimento Sociale Italiano and contributed to a weekly Roman magazine, Asso di Bastani, which was supported by his Europe a Nation. The New European has described Mosley as an avowed Europhile. The Union Movement's meetings were often physically disrupted, as Mosley's meetings had been before the war, and largely by the same opponents. This led to his decision in 1951 to leave Britain and to live in Ireland. He responded to criticism of him abandoning his supporters in a hostile Britain for a life abroad by saying, "You don't clear up a dung heap from underneath it." In the 1950s, Mosley advocated for Africa to be divided into black and white areas, but the decolonisation of the 1960s put an end to this proposal. And some people have said, well, Oswald Mosley would have supported the European Union, but that was a completely different idea. I mean, he's talking here about the individual European nations working together for the good of the nations, not being administrated by a group of people that you don't have actually any say in what they're saying. And there's a famous speech that he gave called Europe a Nation, which is available. And I also found it interesting here, the same people were putting a stop to his meetings. And these people get glorified today. They get lionized. You know, there are books written about the people that fought against Mosley, but they were thugs. You know, they carried razor blades. They carried baseball bats. They put people in hospital. Serious physical violence was carried out against Mosley's supporters. And the people that carried out that violence are just made out to be great heroes today. I've read a few interviews with them, one of them going into detail of this attack that was on Geoffrey Hamm, who was a friend of Mr. I, that we interviewed. But it is totally different. The way that it's portrayed today, that the people that are made to, out to be heroes were just bullies and thugs. I mean, they even have to pretty much admit it here that his meetings were still being attacked by the same people. And what is it, you know, what they're actually saying there is physical violence with razor blades, baseball bats, putting people in hospital. And there was one instance when people, I think they waited outside somebody's flat and then they burst in there and beat him with a baseball bat. And then they had this alibi that they were at a nightclub together. And the people that did that are lionized in these books of what was called the Antifa at the time. And as it says here, a lot of them claim to be representing Jewish interests as well. And it's Jewish groups today that promote these violent thugs as being heroes. Any thoughts on that, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, even organisations like Hope Not Hate have celebrated. I think someone shared something last year about my grandfather used to throw tomatoes that were filled with razor blades at fascists and Nazis or something like that, and Hope Not Hate, one of the guys in Hope Not Hate had retweeted it and liked it. It's just, they have no arguments, and they're not the good guys. They're communists, they're not the good guys. But it's still today, they just encourage violence against us. My husband and I have been attacked in the street before when we've been out leafleting, and luckily my husband boxes and he's a bit handy and he was able to defend us, but they still tried it. And in relation to the points about Europe and nation, I have heard the argument before where people go, oh, Mosley would have voted for the EU, he would have voted for Remain. And it's like, well, I'm not sure that Mosley supports open borders and globalism and, you know, hate speech laws and all that. And I think there's many differences between Europe and nation and the EU. But I would say that I do agree that we do need collaboration between European countries. And at Patriotic Alternative, we have good relationships with, like, the Nordic Resistance Movement in the Scandinavian countries and Les Braves in France and other organisations as well. And at the end of the day, we're all facing the same attacks. So I think it's so important that we work together. And the final thing that I wanted to say about this part is I just think it's a testament to his character that even after everything that he went through in the prior years, he just continued, and he was a true man of action, and he was brave until the end.
Yeah, literally thrown everything at him, haven't they? And they've totally smeared him. And he's still advocating for Europeans as a whole. I think he certainly wouldn't have approved of open borders. I mean, he says here he was advocating for Africa to be divided into black and white areas. So he certainly wouldn't have approved of immigration coming into Europe from areas that were not of European ancestry. I think he would have been really shocked at that. Mosley was a key pioneer in the emergence of so-called Holocaust denial. While not denying the existence of Nazi concentration camps, he claimed that they were a necessity to hold a considerably disaffected population, where problems were caused by lack of supplies due to incessant bombing by the Allies, with bodies burned in crematoria due to typhus outbreaks, rather than gas chambers being used by the Nazis to exterminate people. And he sought to discredit pictures taken from places like Buchenwald and Belsen, and he criticised the Nuremberg trials as a zoo and a peep show. The Nuremberg trials, I mean, they did not have the same rules of evidence that normally apply. They allowed hearsay as evidence, and it has come out since then that the people that were put on the stand, they were tortured. Some of them literally had their testicles smashed beyond repair, and they were threatened that their relatives would all be raped by communists, and they would be thrown to the communists. So you cannot trust the final verdicts of the Nuremberg trials, and it was also the justice of the victors. It's the first time ever that a defeated country had then been put on trial for defending themselves effectively. And so I don't think you can trust those verdicts. And it says it was Holocaust denial, and I'm not sure that he denied that the Jews, a terrible thing happened to them during the war, because it did. I don't think he would have denied that. I think what he was questioning was some of the evidence around the concentration camps. I mean, where it says here that they were holding a considerably disaffected population. You had a lot of people that were partisans. You had people that disagreed with Germany going to war. I think the same thing as what Britain's done, where Britain has put the people that didn't agree with going to war in prison. Germany had people that didn't want to go to war that were also sabotaging the war effort and that were actually carrying out terrorism. So they put those into these concentration camps. So, I mean, what you've got going on in Germany is pretty much similar to what you've got going on in Britain, which I should imagine he was highlighting there. What do you make of this, Laura? Do you know much about his so-called Holocaust denial?
Well, I know that so the technical label of Holocaust denier, and I think, is it it's some museum, isn't it, that gives the technical label of it? So you're technically a Holocaust denier if you question any aspect of the official narrative of the Holocaust. So if you were to say, I think 6 million people were killed, but it was by this method rather than that method, then you're a Holocaust denier. Or if you say, I think that, you know, actually 20 million people were killed or only 2 million people were killed, you're a Holocaust denier. You're not actually allowed to question any aspect of this. And I'm not saying that I'm personally questioning it, but I think every event from history should be able to be questioned. And if people want to question this or investigate this or do this, they have every right to do it. And the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, because obviously there are multiple Holocausts that have happened throughout history, is the only one, to my knowledge, that it's illegal to question in certain countries. And I disagree with that. I think that people should be able to look back at evidence and, you know, come to their own conclusions without being told you're not allowed to do that. So the very definition of Holocaust denier, they use that to sort of like say that you believe that nothing happened, that you believe nothing bad happened to Jewish people during this time period. And of course, you know, horrible things happened to Jewish people during this time period, but they make it out like you don't believe that anything happened at all, so that they can paint you as a bad person. And they still do that today. You know, I mean, I think David Irving is probably the obvious example, who has not said that nothing happened, but he's probably the most famous Holocaust denier because of the things that he's questioned.
So it's exaggerations, isn't it? It's exaggerations that are put in there, saying people don't believe, you know, that the Jews were mistreated during the war, when that's not really what people are questioning. And yeah, we should be able to investigate all of our history. I think we should be encouraged to question things and to investigate things and to prove things for ourselves. And then we become helpful to other members of society, because we can give an informed account of something that we've investigated for ourselves. We've proved something for ourselves. I mean, the whole of science is based upon testing out theories and proving things. It is very, very strange that we have these laws. Thankfully, we don't have them in Britain. We are allowed to investigate World War II in Britain and ask questions. If some countries in Europe, you're not allowed to, particularly Germany. Well, in the wake of the 1958 Notting Hill race riots, Mosley briefly returned to Britain to stand in the 1959 general election at Kensington North. He led his campaign stridently on an anti-immigration platform, calling for forced repatriation of Caribbean immigrants, as well as a prohibition upon mixed marriages. Mosley's final share of the vote was 8.1%. Shortly after his failed election campaign, Mosley permanently moved to Orsay outside of Paris. So that's probably 13, 14 years from the start of the immigration, from the Windrush and the Caribbean, and yet he only got 8% of the vote. Do you know anything about this, Laura, this campaign here?
Well, I know that even though we say mass immigration began in... Sorry, I have a sore throat at the moment. In 1948 with Empire Windrush, the figures were, you know, were small for the first few years. And obviously it was 1968 that we had Enoch Powell and the Rivers of Blood speech. And, you know, the vast majority of the public agreed when he said that things are going too far. But I'm not sure in 1961 what the figures would have been like. I think they still would have been quite small. And maybe for many people, it wasn't a massive issue. I mean, 1961 is actually... a census year, because it ends in a one, so we would have census figures for that year, so it would be interesting to go back. But I don't think that it would be much more than a couple of percent of the population, less than 5% of the population that are not ethnically British. So maybe that's why he didn't get as much as he possibly should have. And then, you know, less than a decade later with Enoch Powell, I think was it 89% of Slough people agreed with him when they went out and did the poll.
Yeah, I think it was of the whole country, wasn't it? It was a poll they did of the punch of the whole country, and everybody agreed with him. Yet the politicians all stabbed him in the back, and said, "We don't agree with you." And the newspapers were all united in the same. Yet the support for him amongst the general population was incredible. And that was another genius politician that was really well liked by the people, that was a part of the establishment, but was then silenced and censored and removed from the establishment for standing up for the people, really, and particularly to do with immigration. Well, in 1961, Mosley took part in a debate at University College London about Commonwealth immigration, seconded by young David Irving. He returned to politics one last time, contesting the 1966 general election at Shoreditch and Finsbury, and received 4.6% of the vote. After this, he retired and moved back to France, where he wrote his autobiography, My Life. In 1968, he remarked in a letter to the Times, "I am not, and never have been, a man of the right. My position was on the left, and is now in the centre of politics." So he's gradually getting less and less support from among the population. But I think he's honest. He says there, it's not right, it's not left. You know, it's just trying to do what's best for your people. Any thoughts on this, Laura?
Yeah, I have grown to hate the concept of left and right, I think, because they're a different issue. I mean, not everyone fits into a box, do they, where you're on the right for everything or you're on the left for everything. And, you know, personally, I would say that I'm quite right-wing on some issues and then quite left-wing on some other issues. And then it changes anyway, doesn't it, depending on what the current narrative is and what the majority of people have, because it's a spectrum. So, you know, to be far something or to be in the centre, it depends on how many people support that. So I do hate the concept of left and right, and people always say to me that I'm right wing, but I'm just like, oh, just call me a nationalist. I don't want to be called right wing. So I understand what Mosley is saying here. And he had to constantly change this because of the, you know, different parties that he was at. Obviously the Tories, Labour and the BUF. I just think we need to get rid of it.
Yeah, I always found it interesting that he ended up going on the right, trying to do the best for his people, and he ended up going on the left, trying to do his best for his people. And that was the central thing, is doing your best for your people. And some of those policies may be right wing, some of those policies may be left wing, but it just seems like a no-brainer to me that's who you want representing you, someone who puts your interests at the centre of everything, your particular group at the centre of everything. And of course, when you have multiculturalism, you can't do that because you've got different groups, and you can only put everything at the centre of one group at a time. You can't do them all at the same time. The country ends up being pulled in all different directions. You know, I think Mosley would have a real shock if he saw the way that the country was today. In 1977, by which time he was suffering from Parkinson's disease, Mosley was nominated as a candidate for rector of the University of Glasgow, in which election he polled over 100 votes but finished bottom of the poll. I mean, that's a great shame that he wasn't honoured with all these things at the end of his life. I should imagine that a lot of this was down to this Regulation 18B and being arrested and being interned and being portrayed as a traitor. As I say, talking to elderly people today, most of them think that Mosley was a traitor. That's the image that they were given. Thanks to Churchill during the war. Mosley's political thought is believed to have influence on the organic farming movement in Great Britain. Henry Williamson, the agricultural writer and ruralist, put the theories of blood and soil into practice, which in effect acted as a demonstration farm for Mosley's ideas for the BUF. In the story of A Norfolk Farm, 1941, Williamson recounts the physical and philosophical journey he undertook in turning the farm's worn-out soil back into fertile land. The tone contained in this text is more politically overt than his nature works. Throughout the book, Williamson makes references to regular meetings he had held with his leader, Mosley, and a group of like-minded agrarian thinkers. Lady Eve Balfour, a founder of the Soil Association, supported Mosley's proposals to abolish Church of England tithes on agricultural land. Mosley's black shirts had protected a number of East Anglian farms in the 1930s from the bailiffs authorised to extract payments to the church. Jorian Jenks, another founder of the Soil Association, was active within the Black Shirts and served as Mosley's agricultural advisor. And Jorian Jenks was also in the prison under 18B. And it's very interesting that today the Green Party and environmentalism has become so associated with the left and communism, whereas really, as it says here, it's blood and soil. That's what nationalism is about. It's about your ancestry and it's about the land that you live upon. Each are equally as important. And nationalism was all about preserving the environment and helping the farmers. Whereas today we've got this Green Party, and they seem to want as much immigration as possible, which is obviously going to harm the environment. They don't want the farmers to be farming. They're concerned about carbon dioxide or methane coming from the cows. They're actually attacking the farmers, and it's the farmers that have preserved the land the way that it is up till today. It's the farmers that know how to do things. They're really central to us, providing all the food for us. You got self-sufficiency. We want to be self-sufficient. All of these things are nationalist ideas. And yet the environmental group, the Green Party that claims to be representing the environment, they're supporting all these communist ideas, ideas that go against the environment. Mainly mass immigration is something that they support. But it's because of the mass immigration that you have to concrete over the country and build more and more houses, and they're causing harm to the environment. And I should imagine they get very embarrassed if you point out that the origins of the Soil Association and organic farming and essentially the Green Party go back to fascism, basically. Any thoughts on this, Laura?
Yeah, their arguments fall apart very easily if you ever manage to pin one on them, although they never debate us on these issues. But you can't support open borders and care about the environment, because our green and pleasant land is being destroyed because we're building houses everywhere. And this figure is 4 or 5 years out of date, but it's worse now. The last time I looked at it, I think it was 86% of population growth comes from immigration. So that's either direct immigrants or immigrants having children and the population expanding that way. So because of immigration, we're having to build all these new houses, which is destroying the habitats of animals. And you know, we're building on the green belt now as well, and on wetland and that kind of stuff. So you can't support open borders and be an environmentalist, even on like a small level, like caring about animals. If you're paving over where they live, you don't care about the environment. So it makes sense that environmentalism or conservationism, whatever you want to call it, it goes hand in hand with nationalism, because nationalism is a love for your land and a love for your people, wanting what's best for your country and wanting what's best for where your people live. And also, you know, your native wildlife and animals as well, wanting them to be safe. And there's a whole ecosystem, you know, we rely on them for things. They rely on us they maybe don't rely on us for things as much. They rely on smaller animals for things. And to keep things going as nature intended, these things need to be protected. So, yeah, we can't continue to grow at the size that we are currently growing at. We need to close the borders. We need to look at repatriation of people who are here. And we don't need to be growing by, what is it now, 250,000 people every year? I think it's even more now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's more than that. I mean, when you look at it and you look at the numbers, you think, well, if the Indigenous British people are not actually reproducing enough to replace themselves, then we're not reproducing enough to fill the houses that we already have. And when you look at it like that, it says that all this new building that we're doing, all these new houses, must be for the growth that comes from the immigration, either from people immigrating here or from people that have immigrated here and that are then producing the next generation or the second or third generation that are needing these houses. So, and all that is doing is limiting the space that we actually have left in the country. When you look out at the countryside, you think how beautiful it is. I mean, a lot of people think that it just appears like that, but it's not. It's thousands of years or hundreds of years of people working the countryside, building the stone walls, leveling the forests, cutting the place up into fields, and then making it productive for us. And all of that is going to end up being tarmacked over, just so that we can keep the economy going and keep building more and more houses. And where does it all end? It ends with people getting their houses flooded at the moment, doesn't it? You pointed out there, Laura, about them building the houses on the wetlands now and the floodplains, because you need the trees to soak up all the water from the land. If you level the trees and you put the houses there, you know, you're going to get flooding there. And we're already seeing that. We're already seeing terrible floods that happen every couple of years because of this. Another point is I wanted to bring up is with the Greens and the environment and with the origins in nationalism. And it was actually the National Socialists that did away with vivisection. You know, they were very concerned about the mistreatment of animals, as well as with the preservation of the environment. I mean, the people that promote the green agenda today, they're basically just all working towards a one world government, aren't they? They're basically working towards internationalism and treaties with all these other countries so that you have a supranational government. And we also find that they want to encourage mixed race children as well. They think that that's a wonderful thing. And you would think, well, if they're trying to preserve the environment, you know, they're trying to preserve the species as they are, why are they not concerned about something like that? You know, changing the subspecies that we have of mankind and encouraging the mixing of them so that we end up being blended out. You know, they're not actually preserving things as they are. And when you think about it that way, you think, well, that's what the Conservative Party should be doing. They're supposed to be conserving things, and they don't conserve anything at all. But at least we have the people that resist against it, like ourselves, Laura. Do you want to add anything else to this bit on the environment here?
Well, I agree with you. And, you know, they're always talking about saving the panda and saving this bird and all this kind of stuff. But they don't care about white people, do they? The rules are completely different to us. That's racist.
Well, it's also this bit here about organic farming. As well, I mean that's today they talk about organic farming. You didn't realise they were doing that all this time ago. That's what the Soil Association is about. It's about promoting farming. So instead of using modern techniques and genetically modified crops and fertilisers and all of that sort of thing to try and get more out of the soil, saying keep the soil organic and put more work into it. So they're encouraging people to do more work, basically, provide more jobs for people and provide more healthier food. And this is this was thought up by this Jorian Jenks. You know, the Soil Association is something today. People are very proud to have a Soil Association logo on their products. And I just find it interesting that which is very much associated with hippie types, originates here with the British Union of Fascists. Now, Oswald Mosley died on 3rd of December 1980 at Orsay. His body was cremated in a ceremony held at the Père Lachaise Cemetery, and his ashes were scattered on the pond at Orsay. His son Alexander stated that they had received many messages of condolence, but no abusive words. All that was a very long time ago, he said. Mosley's personal papers are held at the University of Birmingham's Special Collections Archive. And I think he did do some interviews, didn't he? I seem to remember there was a famous interview where he was accused of being an anti-Semite, and he said that he wasn't an anti-Semite. And I think his son or his grandson has recently been encouraged of having some sympathies towards fascism. Is it his grandson that was involved in racing? Do you know, Laura?
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, Max is the other way, isn't he?
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Hasn't he completely disavowed him?
Yeah, that's the one that I was thinking of, Max Mosley, I think. So his family's ended up disavowing him.
Yeah, I've always hated that quote, "Oh, that was a very long time ago," because I know he's talking about like the, you know, the abuse and stuff that you'd get as a fascist or a member of the BUF or founder of the BUF or whatever. But I imagine having Oswald Mosley as your dad. Like, imagine having that name and being passed that baton. It shouldn't just be like, you know, oh yeah, oh, that was a very long time ago, it's over with now and we're glad. It should be like he didn't do anything wrong, and, you know, defending him. But I don't know if that's through fear or if he genuinely disagreed with his dad. I don't know, but it's such a wasted opportunity. That baton should be taken and you know, carried on into the future.
Well, that was another side of it, was the future, wasn't it? Fascism was futuristic. It was about using the latest technology. I think it wasn't he the first to make a picture disc? They had vinyl with a picture in there, and the picture discs then became used by the pop bands. But he was releasing speeches on picture disc. And the guy that was, I think it was the world's fastest car or the world's fastest speedboat, Donald Campbell, or Campbell was his surname, they had the BUF lightning flash, either on the fastest speedboat or the fastest boat. It was involved with futurism and trying to be futuristic and using technology, but also with learning from the past and doing what was best for the people. And you see that the huge support that he had in these massive meetings that they had at Earl's Court. And then you see people today that might still support him. I think you've got one group up and one by a guy from Scotland. We've interviewed him before at Radio Albion that supports the British Union of Fascists. But it's a very small group today. But there are still people that support him. I don't think it's as big as the support that there is for Mussolini over in Italy. And I do wonder what Enoch Powell thought of him. Whether Enoch Powell and Oswald Mosley ever got together sometime, because it does seem as if they had similar politics, and that they were both around at a similar time, both thought of very highly, and you just wonder, why didn't they get together and start a new party when Enoch Powell became estranged from the Conservative Party after giving his Rivers of Blood speech. He should have really got together with Oswald Mosley at that point. And got a lot of support. I mean, I don't know what Enoch Powell's thoughts were on Oswald Mosley. Do you know, Laura?
No, I don't know. But that would be an iconic duo, wouldn't it? Maybe something to look up and see if they ever spoke about each other. I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, and also, I mean, obviously people still today support nationalism. And I would say that Oswald Mosley was probably the most famous British nationalist of all time. And he got so close to being... getting to be prime minister, even. I say he lost to Neville Chamberlain by 70 votes, I think it was. And like within a few years, Neville Chamberlain was prime minister. He was a member of parliament with the Conservatives, a member of parliament with Labour as well. He had a lot of people in the aristocracy supporting him. And then it all went wrong with the war, basically. And as you pointed out, Laura, then after the war, it was always, the accusation that always gets made against the nationalists is if you go towards nationalism, it's going to end up with another Holocaust. And it's like a referring back to the war. It seems like this movement that he had, it had so much promise and so many people that were joining it. And his economic memorandum that was even used by John Major today, and it was highly thought of at the time, even by Keynes thought highly of it, this economic memorandum. He just had so much promise. It's such a shame that it all amounted to nothing in the end, and his relatives not wanting to carry on the torch. You got any final thoughts on summing up on Oswald Mosley, Laura?
Yeah, well, I mean, he still, I believe this is correct, he still holds the record for the largest indoor political meeting in the world. I don't think anyone's toppled him there. He had, 50,000 in Earl's Court, was it? 50,000, and then another place as well, where there was tens of thousands of people. So I believe he still holds the record for that even today. But I would just say, with regards to Oswald Mosley, he is a controversial figure. He's somebody that, I mean, he's not as controversial as Hitler, but he's somebody that, people kind of know one or two things about him, but they don't know much about him. And I think he's somebody that you can talk about and you don't get too much pushback. I've always been honest. I admire Oswald Mosley greatly. And I've not received much pushback for that at all. And what I would say is, read his books, because I actually haven't finished reading My Life, because it's an absolutely massive book. But I think I've read all of his other books, and they're all really short. They're quite heavy going, so you could maybe read one in like a couple of days, have a little break in the middle or something. But they're all really short. And Tomorrow We Live is my favourite book ever, because that book changed my life. It taught me how broken the current system is, and how the system that we have in Britain today is a system that was created and designed by our enemies in order to leave us ineffective. And because of that book, I although I think that we should pursue the political route and go down it as much as we can and use it to our advantage, I think that our focus needs to be on building our own communities and stepping away from the system and looking at self-sufficiency and being able to support ourselves and that kind of thing. And trying to reform the system as well, of course, that's a massive one. And that's why at PA we focus on community building and activism and acting as a pressure group and that kind of thing. But that book, Tomorrow We Live, it taught me so much. It was like being punched in the gut and just waking up from something. So I would recommend that book just if you want to understand the problems with the system today that we've got. But that's all I'll say. It's been really nice to speak with you, and good luck with, you know, the current struggles that you're going through as well. I hope you get the result that you want, and we're all here to support you whatever happens.
Well, thank you very much, Laura. Thank you very much for coming on today, and thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Do check out the Greatest Britons archive for more on our Greatest Britons. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.